This is CliffCentral.com.
Grant, I need to make a critical business decision. We've been expanding rapidly, and my gut feel tells me that we should be investing for growth. But I need to put some financial science behind that gut feel of mine.
Don't you have a financial manager or director that can help you with that?
But isn't that rather expensive?
It doesn't have to be. Why don't you contact the finance team? They're a consultancy that can provide you with a part-time financial manager or director at a fraction of the cost of a full-time resource.
Go to thefinanceteam.co.za.
Welcome to our Business Masterclass. I'm Richard Angus, CEO of the Finance Team, your part-time financial executive solution. Joining me in studio as part of our panel is Safia Bule of New Habits, Making Shift Happen. Welcome, Safia.
Hi, Richard. Looking forward to today's conversation.
Yeah, I am too. Last week, we launched our Focus on Ethics feature with Cynthia Schumann of the Ethics Monitor. Go and have a listen to that show. Remember our hashtag Keeping Ethics Alive. A great show, a great program, and we're looking forward to spending a week of every month talking about ethics. And I can tell you that this month's show on ethics is the last Monday of the month. It's going to be really a bumper show, so look out for that. Today's theme, cultivating innovators. How can South Africa produce a nation of original thinkers? Joining us in studio is our guest, Miles Thess, Head of Strategic Services at Eiffel Corp. Welcome, Miles.
Thanks, Richard.
Nice to have you with us. So, according to the Global Entrepreneurship Monitor report, approximately 7% of South Africa's adult population is involved with entrepreneurial activities at any one time. I found that number quite interesting. I thought it might be a little higher than that. In order for this to increase, though, and for the targets of the National Development Plan to be reached, original thinking and creativity are just two of the things that need to be addressed. So let's just talk a little bit about why entrepreneurship is a key to a thriving economy. I mean, what's the relevance of original ideas and solutions for local problems, and how does this make entrepreneurs? Miles, I mean, what are you seeing out there? I mean, you're involved in this world. You clearly are a strategic thinker, from judging by your title.
The title says so.
What are you seeing? I mean, you guys are looking at this from a slightly different angle, but I'd like to understand your thoughts in this space.
Look, my view is that, as a society, I think we've got a moral responsibility to try and foster innovation. We've got loads and loads of youth in our population that don't currently, or they're not employed. So the only way that we're going to be able to achieve our goals as a country, as a society, is to give them the opportunity to innovate and thrive in that space.
Okay. So, I mean, when we talk about entrepreneurship and the keys of innovation, and let's go more to the original idea concept. I mean, educator and psychologist Adam Grant defined this term. He said, you get originals. Or what does he mean? I mean, when we talk of an original, what are we referring to? It was kind of an original, as in a descriptor rather than, you know, the noun, so to speak.
Yeah.
So what do we mean by an original in that context of?
I actually liked his definition in this respect. So, you know, he was saying that you don't necessarily have to come up with a new idea that no one's ever seen before. You just have to come up with a specific angle on an idea that already exists, and you take that and you perfect it to become something even more successful.
Okay. So
So that sounds to me a bit like becoming a front runner in a nuanced way of doing things. But sometimes I wondered if you even have to be that nuanced, because the market is so big for some services that it doesn't even seem as though being an original in that context is very necessary. Sometimes the originality is just in being courageous enough.
Absolutely.
Just standing up and showing up and offering the service or the product that you have.
And that willingness to take a chance to potentially fail.
Yes.
And you know, going into it knowing that maybe you won't be 100% successful or as successful as you want it to be, but you're certainly going to learn from the situation. Yeah. And any innovations that could come subsequent to that might be even better. Yeah. So always, you know, be open-armed about this.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, how do you build or foster originals and that original way of thinking? Because, I mean, I did read somewhere somebody made the comment and said, when we're born with free thought, and then everything that happens subsequent to that constrains the way we think. Yeah. We're taught about boundaries. We're taught about limits. Our schooling and education systems build on principles of models and frameworks. And all of this kind of creates, let's call it the box that we all think in. So how do you go about fostering and building those originals? What are you seeing out there?
I think it's important that we create those safe spaces for people to be able to innovate in. So, you know, inherently when people, they want to innovate on something, there's always a level of risk involved in going out and trying something. But if we give people the opportunity to take risks in safe places and tell them and show them how to manage their risks. So it doesn't mean that, you know, someone has an idea, they take this wild flyer on the thing that this widget, whatever it is, might work. Some of the best innovators are the people who are able to manage the risk and come up with contingencies to manage the challenges that they might have expected to appear.
Mm. Now, I mean, when you talk about managing risk, Sophia and I kind of look at each other and go, ooh, here comes the risk managers.
So I also hear something else. I mean, like I just read somewhere quite randomly this morning where they actually say that most entrepreneurs on their journey have failed at least twice before. So it's almost as if risk-taking is so critical and failure is so critical to the journey, so that your relationship with risk and failure needs to be kind of one of the starting blocks.
You have to be comfortable to fail.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it's almost like, you know, have you failed twice? Yes. Okay, then you must be an entrepreneur.
Should become like a... So one of the safety elements there is like it becomes part of the badge of honour.
Yeah.
The journey towards...
I've been there, done that,
burnt the T-shirt.
Burnt it?
Mm. Yeah.
I was having a conversation with some of our customers sometime. We actually came up with this term. We called it positive anxiety. So it's almost like this people's obviously innate need to develop themselves, do better.
Yeah.
But you also need a bit of, you know, there's a what if. Yeah. What if this doesn't work? What if I don't make succeed? What is my plan going to be when things don't go so well?
Yeah.
So we need that in everything we do, right? Because we can't do anything without some sense of risk, without losing something if this thing doesn't actually take off.
Yeah.
And I think we are pre-wired from a very early age not to want to take risk. I mean, we're told, you know, don't touch the hot, you know, that's hot, don't touch it. How hot is it? And is it going to burn me? You know, I mean, I'll often say that, oh, don't touch that, it'll burn you. You know, it's hot enough. If it's hot, but it's not going to burn you, maybe I want you to experience the heat and feel and know, okay, so that's a hot thing, you know. And it's that question of what perhaps your parenting style might be in terms of how you handle your kids, you know, or don't, you know, don't do this or don't do that. You know, it, you know, only serve up how much you can eat. No, actually, you're free to use the entire 2 liters of ice cream, but understand if you serve it, you're going to finish it. You know, there's the boundary, you know. And so we're conditioned, I guess, we always, and society puts natural boundaries in place. You know, there's the speed limit, there's acceptable social graces. This is, you know, pleases and thank yous, and this is how it works. So there's the natural order of things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And there are some rules that are immutable, you know, that if you let it go, it will fall and it will hit the ground. It is called gravity. No matter what you do, you can't stop this. But there are other laws and principles that we constrain our thinking with. You know, if you'd said to somebody years ago, you're going to walk around with a telephone without a cable, they would have said to you, nah, never. Mobile technology drives the world.
Mm.
Okay. So the rule that, you know, there's that old saying of, you know, the rules are there to be broken. Okay. Certain rules are there to protect, but other rules are there to be broken and to be challenged. Now, I guess the question is, you know, how do you go about creating this, let's call it rule challenging and creative thinking? Because I mean, my experience of school and varsities and the likes, as I said, you know, I mean, let's go just step one back to a university environment.
Right.
Okay. You know, you have to answer questions in a fixed model and give an answer to, you know, here's the question, give me a solution and I'll mark it and I'll tell you whether you passed or failed. Now, is that a good system to use to evaluate people and tell them whether they're successful or a success or failure in life?
Well, I mean, in terms of those measures you just mentioned, it is. It works well. The system works well. I want you to know this. Here's a test. Pass. You know, you're ready to go. But, I mean, I think we've seen that that's not really – it doesn't really fit the measure anymore, right? I mean, we're expecting students to come out of university, out of colleges, to be well prepared for the workplace, and oftentimes that isn't, right? And it's those soft skills, it's that spark we're looking for that differentiates the best graduates from a lot of the mediocre ones, right? Those are the ones that are prepared to make, you know, take the initiative potentially to go and learn about what it is that they're going to do, learn about the opportunities that exist in their chosen industry. So I think, universities, to be fair, it's a model that's been around for a very long time. So I think hopefully it doesn't take as long to change the model. That we could be here for a while. But certainly it is happening in places, and I think a lot of educators are starting to see that they need to change and adapt their learning programs so that it can give the learners the opportunity to start. Mm. You know, we always talk about critical thinking, but, you know, in our experience, it doesn't happen all the time, or it happens in sort of small pockets. Mm. And that's the type of thinking you need to foster more.
Mm. Mm. So if I were employing a young person or any person with that kind of, for that matter, and I wanted to foster this concept of critical thinking. And you know, when you speak of the originals, as per Adam Grant, the word that pings around in my head is an entrepreneurial spirit, mm-hmm. more than being original. It's a way of showing up. How do I, as an employer, create a space where original thinking is possible? Because our nature is not to be. Our nature is to play inside that box. We're not even aware of the box.
Yeah, and it's awesome. I mean, you know, as a young person who joined the workforce, I was quite intimidated, right? Yeah. I mean, here's these people. They've been doing this for years and years. They've got all the experience. Yeah. You know, who am I to go and say, well, that idea isn't that great. Have you heard about mine? You know, there's some people have the gall to do that. It's amazing. You know, I wasn't one of those people. But, you know, again, coming back to that comment on safe spaces. So, you know, oftentimes companies talk about innovation, but they don't necessarily allow it to happen inside the organization. So we work with a number of, you know, corporates, obviously a lot of the universities. But it oftentimes they don't give them the opportunity to express the ideas in a way that it's going to be conducive to be listened to and given its, you know, sort of giving the idea the full respect of what it actually deserves. Mm. And we also need to back that up maybe with some funding sometimes. So, you know, some ideas are only going to go so far as an idea. Sometimes they do need a bit of a, you know, cash injection to get them going. So we need to come up with models that enable that to take place.
Yeah. I must say the one thing that as you say that, there's a group of investors globally. I'm just names slipping me for now. Where they invest in 500 500 startups.
Yes, I've heard of these guys. Yeah.
And basically, what they do is they follow an approach. So the traditional approach is select the best idea carefully. What they do is they say fund all great ideas. And out of the 500, you'll get 5 or 10 great ideas that make you enough money. So they kind of go with the, let me call it the peanut butter spreading approach, as opposed to the all eggs in one basket approach from a venture capitalist perspective. And I listen to this and I think to myself, wow. I mean, imagine if, you know, any venture capitalist or anybody generating ideas, and you can do this internally inside your organization. You go, okay, so we want to spend, you know, 100,000 rand on innovative thinking in our environment. Instead of spending 100,000 rand on one idea and everybody pitch your idea to get the 100,000 rand, we're going to spend 10 grand on 10 great ideas. Come guys, tell me what we could do. What would, you know, what will move the needle by putting 10 grand behind it? And what ideas? What are the 10 best ideas to move things forward? And can we do it with 10 grand each? So yeah, different approaches. But I do think the portfolio move forward holistically and like let's call it collectively often works really nicely. Now, I mean, when we talk about schooling and varsity and the rest, I mean, I've heard the saying that says our children are currently being educated for jobs that don't yet exist. And that, I have a 13-year-old daughter and a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old, and that statement just scares me.
But isn't the statement inaccurate, Richard? Isn't it they're being educated for jobs that will no longer exist?
Well, yeah, exactly. That's also so there's two sides. So they're going to have to do things that they're not being prepared for by the current systems. And you go to school and you say to the kids, so what do you want to be when you grow up? Okay. I do feel like I have to pass grade 3 multiple times. Yes. What do you want to be when you grow up? And the child looks at you and says, what I want to be, you don't even know about yet, dude. I mean, you can imagine you'd want to give that smart child a backhand and say, like, stop being so disrespectful. Yeah. But that's actually the truth. There are professions and services that are still going to be around. I mean, the reality is, you're always going to need the good old undertakers and the tax man. We all know that. Stop giving me the evil eye, sir.
I'm sure robots will take that one eventually, as well.
Yeah, but I mean, everybody, the one that always amazed me was people always said, doctors. Well, actually, medical artificial intelligence is actually far ahead of many other professions, purely because of the risk associated with getting it wrong and misdiagnosing. Mm-hmm. And the breadth of knowledge of symptoms and impacts of things not working the way they should. They say that the medical profession is actually going to be one of the first professions to actually have, let's call it AI, start taking artificial intelligence, taking the place of the human being. Mm. Purely because they the interesting thing is, and doctors say we'll welcome it. And the other and the kind of flip with that is also, and there are not enough doctors in the world for the people that need to be cared for. So by implication, AI type solutions are going to be needed because of the imbalance of the patient to doctor ratio is just out of kilter globally.
Yeah, so I mean, the great thing about technology is that it's going to give us the opportunity to actually specialize even more so than we have now. So it will take away a lot of the menial type stuff, and people can concentrate and get involved in things like research. Talking about the medical field, that'll certainly happen. Mm. But I think a bit of a misnomer to say that we're training them for jobs that don't exist. Well, what do they know that they're going to need to do? So I mean, let's not try and focus on training people in pure rote learning. Obviously they need the theory, that's fine. We need people to be accredited. We need to know that they know the stuff they need to know, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the basics. But I think we need to impart on them the abilities to actually develop themselves and learn from it, sort of in an agile way. So, if you have an eye on a particular type of skill or an industry, what are the things that you're going to constantly have to do to keep yourself relevant, to keep yourself professionally ready to carry out the work that you're doing? And to keep learning. I mean, we all say that we need to do that, but how many people really develop themselves all the time?
Well, the concept of learn to learn.
That's it.
Yeah. So, Miles, I don't know if I'm off base, but I'm almost hearing you saying that for businesses to be relevant in the future, yes, on the one hand, people have to learn to learn in a way that maintains relevance. But are you also saying that we have to create work environments as business owners and as leaders and as managers that facilitates that? Because as you guys are speaking, I'm almost thinking innovation is not going to be innovative. Innovation is just going to be the baseline for survival.
You're almost saying it, right? I mean, people are going to have to justify all the time why they're valuable to a business. So, the point is going to come where people's jobs will be threatened by automation. Now, if I can't prove that I'm more valuable to a business in what I do than a robot is, I mean, if you're looking at this from a business owner, it's an easy equation, right? And it's a hard truth I think we have to face. So we have to continuously develop ourselves in order to find that new specialization, that new level of innovation. And it means, I mean, it's good. It means we're investing in ourselves as well. And, we will do well as will the business do well out of what we do.
So you're almost saying that we've got to start doing things that is almost unnatural for most human beings to do. Because, I mean, if you think about small business owners, very often they don't become large businesses purely because they can't make the decisions and the changes and the adjustments so they can scale up.
Certainly.
And this is now going to be an even bigger burden or demand on them to...
And I think there's an important thing there, because what we talk about in scaling up a business often is create the processes, create the guidelines and the structure that allows you to do this multiple times in a very cost effective way and actually scale. So, you know, kind of the words that flow are, you know, make this repeatable and make it excellent. And I'm going, okay, that's great theory from the past, but if I look at where this is going, the reality is maybe that's why scaling is so difficult in the new, let's call it the new economy, and is going to become increasingly more difficult, because the ability to use that mental model and framework and how we did it in the past and scale, you know, 10 times is now maybe not as cut and dry as one may have thought it was.
Because there's a large element, Miles, for me, of scaling up. On the one hand, you've got to do that, but simultaneously you've got to be reinventing things on an ongoing basis. And it's not normal for people to do that. There are these odd people, these originals that Adam Grant speaks about that does that. For the rest of us, we're not designed that way. What do we do?
Yeah, I know. We like the day-to-day. We like the you know, predictability of, you know, coming to work every day and doing the same thing. But I think that's changing. I mean, you know, the invention of the app started that. You know, now you can have a thing that does something just for you, you know, and it's customized just the way you want it. You know, how are we going to meet the needs of all those people just with all those very specific needs and very specific requirements? And I think this all, it kind of all fits together with this whole gig economy thing as well, you know. Everything is, as you just said, you know, it's not just about, you know, let's print 10 of these and we'll sell the same one. Everybody wants a customized experience. Everybody wants something different. And that's, I think that's true of businesses as well. We can't just keep just doing over the same thing and hoping that's going to work, right?
So how does one go about making sure that you've got that, let's call it that flexible, innovative, let's call it culture? I'm looking for words here, but I think culture is probably the closest word I can find that allows that culture and the innovation to flow. How does one ensure that? Because it feels kind of counterintuitive in most organizations.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, certainly for big corporates, you know, a big theme for a lot of them is control. You know, now we've, you know, the guys that were the innovators the other day are now, they're all coping with the problems of big businesses. You know, we've got the model, it works, we're printing money, let's just keep doing this, right? But to be nimble, and, you know, I'm sure there's lots of examples of this in the business world, you have to start listening, you know, listening from multiple sources as well. Listening to people within your business, listening to your intuition, and somehow putting all these things together to come up with a plan to take on the challenges that lie ahead. I don't think that there's a, you know, a manual that you can print out and said, these are the rules of innovation and doing these things will ensure that you stay relevant and that, you know, you will make money out of your idea. And let's not forget, I mean, there's a lot of ideas around innovation in the social space as well, you know, and these aren't people that necessarily make money out of the ideas, but they're good for us from a social perspective. So it comes from multiple sources, and I think the very first part of that is being able to listen. Again, giving people safe spaces to air their ideas and giving them the support to try those ideas, potentially fail, and see what the outcomes are. You know, so take them as far as they go and take other outcomes from, because obviously the sharing of those ideas and making those attempts, other ideas can stem from those as well. And also looking across industries as well. So sometimes I don't think we actually go far enough in the search for new ideas. So I mean, if you take this in, you know, in the university context, you know, maybe someone from accounting and maybe someone from, you know, the geophysics department has something in common. But how do we know? Because we don't often let those people, we don't bring them together. You know, I mean, it's an odd combination. But I mean, it's
back in the day when I was at Wits, we were on the West Campus and those people were on the East Campus.
That's how
Yeah, but now I'm just thinking about it. You got the law background, Sophia. We were on the same type of campus.
Lawyer. No, we won't.
No, you and I won't. But the law, what I'm saying is the law and the accountants were on the same.
All the people who think in, and I'm sure the engineers and all those people occupy the same kind of space.
Yeah, I know. The engineers were on the upper side of West Campus.
You're so classist, Richard.
Yeah, but the lawyers and the accountants had to share a common set of libraries and space and all this. I don't know how they put all of the geeky professionals together, I guess.
So in the work I do, which is really, you can call it whatever you like, but it's really about helping people to communicate better. One of the most difficult things, especially for business owners or people who classify themselves as experts, knowers of things, one of the most difficult things for them to do is to listen. So if you were to give our listeners advice right now on listening better so that they can hear the opportunities and see what's possible, what would it be to help them to actually be able to hear all the ideas that are floating around them on a daily basis?
You know, I think you've said it there. I mean, the first of all, I think they just have to take the first step and recognize that they do need to listen. Mm-hmm. And I think also extracting themselves out of their businesses, because oftentimes, you know, we all deal with the day-to-day. Mm. It's difficult to see the wood from the trees, right? I mean, you're so busy just trying to get stuff done. Yeah. Now someone tells you, right, we've got to, you know, think up an idea or a strategy for the next 5 years. I mean, it's difficult as it is.
Yeah.
Listen to the people inside your business. You know, the biggest and the best ideas don't necessarily come from the people with the loudest voices. You know, if you create a forum for people to express themselves in a way that they know they will be taken seriously, and it's, like I said, it's a safe space. A lot of people are, you know, very scared of venturing an idea because they don't know how well it's going to be received.
Okay.
That's potentially something to do. And also listen to the people that I think have newly joined your business. I don't know if this happened to you, but I mean, I've joined, you know, 2-3 different companies, and you know, once you've got a little bit of the knowledge about what the company does and some of the processes, there's a sort of a sweet period of about sort of 2 to 3 months after you've joined, you kind of start of asking, like, but why can't we do these things? Like, what stopped you from doing this before? And other people are like, you know, actually, you're right. I mean, why didn't we ever think of that? You know, I've certainly found that experience when I've joined new companies. And as far as I know, they've actually done some research into this, that there's a sort of a sweet period of time between when you've joined and before you know too much, and you've seen, you know, when you know where all the gargoyles are and, you know, all the ingrained things that just don't work, that you can actually ask that. You have that benefit of being a newcomer as well, because people can say, you know, well, you know, he doesn't really know enough yet to be responsible for what he's saying. So he can say that type of thing. So people really should try and listen to those people.
Mm. Well, it's been great chatting. It's really interesting as we think about these things. Next up is our business review session. Miles is going to be staying on with us. Stay with us.
This is CliffCentral.com.